listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is your host, Dr. Hal Schurz, and along with my co-host, Dr. Michael Karuchik, we come to you every week to discuss topics that doctors discuss among themselves in lounges and in hospitals all around the country. We give you the information that you'll need so that you can fight for your healthcare freedom. Our show is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, which is a nonprofit tax-deductible organization founded by doctors who are deeply concerned about the direction that healthcare is going in. The foundation offers solutions very different than those that have been enacted by bureaucrats in Washington and different than what you may have been hearing in the newspapers and on TV. We believe that if you are armed with the information you need to fight for your healthcare freedom, then we will be able to preserve the doctor-patient relationship, which is very much in jeopardy right now. So please go to the website, patientcarefoundation.org, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org, and please contribute generously so that we can continue this fight. If you like what you hear on this radio show, this is what the foundation is bringing to you and what your contributions will allow us to continue to do. Well, today I am pleased and honored to have an old friend joining me on the show today, Dr. Joe Vecchio, whom I have had the opportunity to meet when we first started the Docs for Patient Care membership organization over 6 years ago. And Jill is a accomplished breast cancer radiologist. She is a political figure in the Colorado area. She's a graduate of the Leadership Program of the Rockies, which has produced some very prestigious fellows. She has had a radio show of her own in the Denver area called The Heart of the Matter, where she discussed Constitution and founding principles and brought the information and background in medicine to this show. And today we're honored to have her on the show so that we can revisit a subject that has been pretty much been in hibernation for the last few years, and that's the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommendations on screening. And specifically, today we'll talk about screening of breast cancer, which she's an expert in, but we'll also talk about screening of other things such as prostate cancer, which I know a little bit about as a practicing urologist. So, Jill, welcome to the Doctor's Lounge.
Thanks for having me, Hal.
And it's early in the Denver area, so thank you for rising early and joining us and helping us to bring this important information to our listening audience.
You know, doctors never really sleep. So actually, this is when I usually get up anyway. I'm just usually having to get ready to go to work myself.
Okay, well, excellent. Well, then we'll get right into it. So, Jill, you know, we have talked just so much about this U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. And I think that it would be important, you know, this is an audience that are just not are not only comprised of physicians, but of people who are non-medical people. So why don't we take a moment and explain what this task force is?
So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is a group of mostly physicians. Sometimes they will have health insurance representatives from the health insurance industry on the task force. It's made up of 16 members. I went through the member list for this task force recommendation this year, and they're public health physicians who aren't really practicing physicians. They study statistics and populations. They don't take care of patients. And the other physicians are MDs, usually primary care doctors. One of the most distressing things about these panel members on these USPSTF, these task force panel members is that they never have specialists on the panel that are work with patients every day in the area on which they're making recommendations. So there's not a single breast radiologist or even a radiologist. There's no breast surgeons, no oncologists that deal with breast cancer on the task force. So the people on the task force really don't ever deal with breast cancer and breast cancer patients unless there's somebody in their family or something or they themselves have had some experience with it. So it's really kind of silly that these people are making these recommendations that have a great impact on our health care and what our insurance will cover. Sometimes those recommendations, for instance, in Colorado, whenever these task force panels come out with a set of recommendations, it automatically becomes Colorado statute. So then the insurance companies have to reimburse or pay for coverage based on Colorado statutes as their mandates, their insurance mandates.
So
if those task force guidelines change, people's insurance changes drastically overnight.
So I want to be clear that this is not a creation of Obamacare.
These have existed for a long time.
Right. They actually were created back in 1984, I believe.
I think that's right.
And but Obamacare, I think it's important to tie this to the Affordable Care Act because there was a change in the USPSTF. Let's just call it, you know, the task force for brevity in our conversation. So the task force, their role changed as a result of the Affordable Care Act, didn't it?
Well, yes. And you know, I've read through the whole law and given a bunch of talks on it. And the task force recommendations will affect, and they do affect, Medicare reimbursement because the task force has recommendations that are A, B, C, D, and I based on how strongly they do or don't recommend or if there's insufficient information in the literature to make a recommendation one way or another on something, so that the Medicare and Health and Human Services for all the government reimbursement uses those guidelines to say what they will and won't pay for patients, how often they will and won't pay for things. And so the government, through their regulatory branch and Health and Human Services and so forth, will determine just on their own, by themselves, what they will and will not reimburse and how seriously they may or may not take their panel, the task force panel's recommendations.
So tell us why with, you know, breast cancer, for example, where we're talking about women who are younger women for the most part, but there are older women on Medicare that would fall under the government regulations and government health plans. Most of these women are not affected by Medicare. Why does that make a difference?
Because Medicare reimbursement is really kind of, and you could maybe find a good word to describe this, but all of our reimbursement in private practice and through third-party payers, managed care, insurance companies, really comes from Medicare. It's all, you know, they use a multiplier of Medicare to determine how much money we're going to get reimbursed for different things. Now, sometimes you can contract with an insurance company or something to get paid differently, but usually it's based on some percentage of or some multiplier of Medicare reimbursement. So if Medicare makes a change, it affects the whole system. And I think that's not emphasized enough. It really affects the entire system. So if Medicare decreases our reimbursement by 25% or stops paying for something, you can be pretty darn sure that everybody else is going to follow suit. And then whatever that procedure or service is not going to be very, very much available because nobody gets paid for doing it.
Right. So let's be clear. So what you're saying is that Medicare is the standard by which the insurance companies pretty much base their reimbursement on. There's a multiplier involved, and insurance companies reimburse Medicare times a certain multiplier, but if Medicare is not going to cover a procedure because it's gotten a rating under B, and that's what guidelines now state anything that's less than a B will not be covered by Medicare, then the insurance companies are watching this very carefully, and they're going to say, well, if Medicare isn't going to cover it, neither are we.
Right. Exactly right.
So that's why this is important for everyone, even though this is, you know, just a Medicare issue initially. But what the task force was empowered to do, and you've alluded to this, they were elevated from an advisory committee to an actual bona fide agency or bureau within the Affordable Care Act matrix.
Yes. Now, that being said, after the 2009 guidelines came out, and the ones that they're proposing now are really no different than the 2009 guidelines.
Are they the same, Jill?
They're virtually identical.
But now this whole issue got put on the back burner, didn't it?
Yes. Well, in 2009, there was such a hoopla from all of the different societies, American Cancer Society, Society of Breast Imaging, American College of Radiologists, American College of Surgeons, everybody had a fit about the 2009 guidelines saying, you know, this is ridiculous. Women are going to die because of these guidelines.
You got to
change these. And then there's a little footnote at the bottom of the 2009 guidelines on their website that says in very tiny print, for the purposes of the Affordable Care Act, the 2002 task force guidelines will be used for reimbursement and anything regarding the Obamacare.
So before you go on,
it was really kind of funny the way they snuck around that. But I think it was Senator Stark or something that had something to do with that.
Well, Congressman Stark. But before you go any further, why don't you explain what the guidelines are?
Okay, so let me go to my page here. The guidelines are, and there are no, so I said there's a ranking of B, C, D, and I. So A is definitely strongly recommend blah, blah, blah. There's not a single A recommendation for any mammography guidelines, not one. So here, women ages 50 to 74 years old, the task force recommends screening every other year for women between 50 and 74 years old. After 74, they claim that there's not enough evidence in the literature to determine whether it's beneficial to continue screening mammograms for women over 74. Well, I got some patients that are over 74. They're in better shape than I am. And, you know, and plus, breast cancer, you're more likely to get breast cancer the older you get.
Yes.
So they're really, technically, they're at increased risk for breast cancer. And now we're saying we're not recommending that you get any mammography after that, or you know, you might have to pay for it yourself in cash. Because in high recommendation, they may or may not reimburse.
Okay, so let's say this again. So women between the ages of 50 and 74, and we have 1 minute till break. Women between the ages of 50 and 74, that is the task force has given that a B rating, correct, for screening every other year. So that means that they'll pay for it. But women over 74 have gotten an I rating because there's inconclusive evidence and they won't pay for it. And women who are under age 50 have gotten a C rating. Is that correct?
Exactly, a C rating. And we can talk about that when we come back.
And we will talk about that when we come back from the break. You're in the doctor's lounge.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
Did you miss the show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
You're listening to the Doctor's Lounge. This is your host, Dr. Hal Schurz. My guest today is Dr. Jill Vecchio, and we're talking about breast cancer screening. So, Jill, we left off with the C rating that the task force has given to screening women under age 50.
Yeah, can I make one more point about the 50 to 74?
Of course.
They call it biennial screening. That means you only get a screening mammogram every other year. Well, I'm, 55, and I had a normal mammogram last year. This year I had a small cancer, so I'm undergoing treatment for that. If I had waited a whole other year, I wouldn't be undergoing, I wouldn't have had the option of minimal treatment. I would have had a bigger cancer. I don't know, I may or may not have been able to feel it somewhere in between there in that two-year period. But over a two-year period, I can tell you that the cancer is going to be bigger, and there's a much stronger chance that it will have spread to my lymph nodes so that I would have chemotherapy, have a much higher risk that I'd have breast cancer in the future, a much higher risk of dying of breast cancer
okay.
by waiting 2 years instead of having it every year.
Well, we're really glad that you caught it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we now understand that the task force is restricting screening on women, and talk about war on women. This is, split hairs, I can't think of anything that is more harmful to women than denying them the kind of care that the other professional societies recommend for the screening of this disease.
Right.
So
yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Virtually every professional society that deals with breast cancer directly.
Okay.
Like the surgeons, the oncologists, the gynecologists, and radiologists, all of us recommend, go with the American Cancer Society recommendations of every year screening mammogram starting at age 40 until the woman no longer wants to have them.
Okay. So are the professional societies that you've mentioned, the radiologists, the breast cancer surgeons, the oncologists, the American Cancer Society, are they pretty much on the same page as together on these recommendations, their recommendations?
Yes. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology actually recommends your first screening mammogram at age 35, and they've done that for years. I think they're in the process of maybe changing it to age 40.
Okay.
So they kind of recommend an earlier one, but I think it's important for people to know that the incidence of breast cancer has increased from 1 in 11 about 20 years ago to 1 in 8.
Now,
and we still don't know what causes it.
Do you think
there's really no way to say who's really truly high risk?
Do you think that represents some kind of change in the disease, or do you think that's a function of better detection?
I think that our detection levels right now are probably pretty stable. It's and certainly at one point we were detecting things smaller and earlier because the technology was getting that much better, and we were getting better at it. But I can tell you from my experience over being a breast, this is my specialty, breast imager over 20 years, that breast cancer has changed. It's changed significantly.
How so?
It's like things that we would see on ultrasound or mammography before 20 years ago, when we'd say, oh, that's completely benign according to all these studies that have been done, that's now cancer. We're finding those things are now cancer. So we're having to lower our threshold for what we biopsy because we're finding out, oh, my God, that thing was cancer? Are you kidding me? That shouldn't have been cancer. So it's becoming more difficult. It can be very ornery.
So
breast cancer will always keep us humble because just when we think we've got it down. Okay, this is not going to be cancer. And we end up doing a biopsy, and it's cancer. And you're going, holy smokes.
So the more we find out, the less we know.
Exactly. It's scary. Breast cancer is just one armory load bugger, and you can't let your guard down for a second.
So we have people who specialize in breast cancer detection, screening, saying one thing, and the task force saying something completely different. Why is that?
It's the motivation. You know, it's just kind of a, what I'm motivated by finding cancer and making sure that I find it as early as possible so women have to have as less treatment as possible, more treatment options, and that they can live their lives and be contributing members of society for as long as possible without having to worry about this. The task force, their motivation is to save money. That's it, period. And this isn't, you know, they call it patient-centered care. No. This is payment-centered care. It's all about money. It's all about decreasing what government has to pay for, and if they want to socialize health care, in other words, if they want the government to take over health care like it has in almost every other country in the world, for the most part, they're going to have to figure out how to deal with mammography the same way that the UK and all these other countries have cut back, especially Canada. Now Canada just recommends 50 to 74 every 3 years a screening mammogram because it costs money. This is, you know, when you have the government paying for mammography and all the biopsies and all the follow-ups and the ultrasounds and everything else that goes with it, they want to decrease those costs. And this is the easiest way to do it. And all you have to do is be like these task force. The last two task force, 2009 and now this one, 2015, they make up their own computer models. If they can't find research in the literature that showed, that proves what point they want to make in order to support their recommendations, they make up a computer model that will support what they say.
Explain how that works.
I'd really like to know, I mean, well, it's with our tax money, obviously, but they're, like, for instance, this year, on their draft recommendation form, if you go to their website, it's insane. They talk about, let me see if I can pull it up here, recurrent radiation exposure from a program of mammography screening, and they say may slightly increase the risk of developing breast cancer, although no empirical studies have directly measured this effect, and that's true. There's not a single study that, well, they've measured it. They know what the radiation dose is and how it compares to other radiation doses, you know, for ambient radiation, living at high altitude, like in Colorado, so forth, and I can talk about that because it's important for people to understand their risk. But so they couldn't find a study that talked about the risk of the radiation from having all these screening mammograms, you know, whether or not that could cause breast cancer. So they made up a computer model that showed that it may cause breast cancer. I don't know what kind of a model they made up or how they did it, but it's kind of like, okay, this is ridiculous. You're making up your own statistics.
So in other words, they have a conclusion, and they're building a computer model around the conclusion to support it.
Absolutely.
You know,
so now their conclusion in 2015 is that, oh, well, let's see, in 2009, nobody liked those recommendations, so now we have to make it seem like mammography is more ominous, and mammography is now the bad guy. So mammograms can cause cancer, and it's ridiculous. They're saying that it may cause cancer in up to 7 per 100,000 women. Well, that's ridiculous, because living in Colorado, just living in Colorado at this altitude, so we have more radiation exposure from the atmosphere, that is equal to 4 mammograms in a year. Living in Colorado for 1 year is equal to having 4 mammograms in a year.
Right.
Flying from round trip from Los Angeles to New York, round trip, flying is equal to 1 mammogram. So if you have people that are business travelers, they should be having breast cancer right and left.
Yes.
Colorado does have a slightly elevated, or it used to have a slightly elevated risk. I don't know if it does anymore. It used to have a slightly elevated risk of breast cancer compared to the general population in the country. And that may be due to the elevation. But you should have a lot more if you're talking about 4 times radiation exposure every single year for women who, and women who grew up in Colorado should have much more breast cancer than women who didn't grow up in Colorado.
Right.
That live there now.
And
you
that, you know,
it's kind of like, it doesn't make any sense. Their conclusions are outrageous.
That's right. And I think that the, we've talked about this before, but one of my professors loved to say, never let the data interfere with your conclusions. And I think this is a perfect example of that. But, you know, you talked about the pseudoscience that they have created to support those conclusions. There was an interesting article that came out this week, in the Washington Post about this very topic, entitled Stop Routine Breast Cancer Screenings, Science Has Shown They Don't Save Lives. Talk about that.
Well, you know, and it's crazy. I read that article, and they never give any solid evidence for their that insanely inflammatory title. They never say. They say something about Sweden is thinking about doing this. Well, Sweden came out with a huge study in 2010 that showed that screening mammography annually beginning at age 40 decreased breast cancer deaths by at least 29%. And after that, I think it was 2010, 2011, two other huge studies came out that followed women for something like 14 years over in the tens of thousands of women, one from Finland, I think it was, and one from the U.S., that showed that breast cancer screening annually beginning at age 40 decreased the number of women who die from breast cancer by 30 to 40%.
That's amazing.
Now, that's dying. And right. These task force guidelines also, you know, they focus only on mortality, only on deaths of women.
Right.
Well, you know what? There's a lot more than just dying from it.
Of course. It's quality of life.
How about having a little part of your breast removed with some radiation treatment, and you have the rest of your breast, and believe me, a lot of these ladies, you can't even tell they've had breast cancer.
Right.
And then you live the rest of your life with your breast.
Right.
Rather than having something diagnosed when it's much larger so that you have chemotherapy, you lose your hair, you're at increased risk for complications from chemotherapy, you lose one or both of your breasts, you have a lot of lymph nodes taken out under your arms so that you have a risk of having permanent arm swelling, lymphedema we call it. I mean, it's just awful.
So
it's ridiculous that they don't seem to care about the morbidity.
No,
there,
again, you mentioned this already, and it's about money. It's about health care population management, not patient management. And
right.
And this is really where we're getting to, where patients are losing their ability to make decisions because somebody else is paying for it. And the conclusions that these groups reach are based on their assumptions, and they're using the data that aren't necessarily the correct data to support those conclusions. But we're going to talk a little bit more about that and other screenings and other recommendations that have been made that are ill-founded and poorly based when we come back from the break in the Doctor's Lounge.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on americaswebradio.com.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. people all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
You're back in the Doctor's Lounge with Hal Schurz. I want to thank our listening audience and those who have downloaded our shows off of the website and off of iTunes. We measure the success of this show based on how many downloads have occurred. And I'm happy to report that we have really exceeded our expectations. The number of downloads that we've had over the last several months have averaged about 14,000 per month, which is a tremendous accomplishment for a show that's not quite a year old. And I would like to just ask everyone to send around the podcast that you're listening to and continue to listen. The show is a live show on Thursday mornings, but it's rebroadcast throughout the week, so please check listings on the website and tell your friends and send it to all of your contacts in your social media world so that we can get the word out about the things that we're talking about every week. My guest this morning is Dr. Joe Vecchio, and we've been talking about the United States Preventative Services Task Force reintroduction of breast cancer screening regulations. And when we, before we went to the break, we were talking about the misinformation or the slanted information that these organizations that want to make population recommendations use to change practice patterns that are accepted practice patterns by experts in the field. And one of the things, Jill, that this Washington Post article pointed out with regard to this is that people who are looking regularly at breast cancer and screening more regularly and making the diagnosis more often are possibly even over-diagnosing this problem and putting women who would be not necessarily at risk for a problem with a small breast cancer, they're treating them and creating a survivor mentality. You saw that, and I'm sure you had a strong gut reaction to that.
Well, and that over-diagnosis is an argument that's been made the last several years, where they say, well, this little cancer would not have become a big cancer. Really? Okay, why don't you point out, let me line up all my breast cancer diagnoses, all my patients, I'm going to line them all up, and you point to the ones who aren't going to, whose cancer is not going to get bigger, whose cancer is not going to be a life-threatening cancer in a year or two. One that we found that was very small. And of you patients, how many of you patients would rather that we not have done the biopsy and not have found a small cancer that you were then treated for and put into a high-risk surveillance, you know, category? How many of you, just raise your hand if you wish that we'd not found your cancer, okay? So that we know who we can just, you know, take out of the fold and not screen anymore. It's just the hindsight is 20/20. And for them to come back and say, oh, well, that little cancer, you know, if you can tell me exactly which cancers, okay, on a mammogram, which cancer can I look at and say I don't need to do anything with that? When you can tell me that with certainty, then I'll be happy to step back and say, okay, we don't need to do anything. The cancer looks like that, and all the time, nobody dies from that cancer.
You know,
but they can't do that. They kind of get up on their pious little high horse and say in retrospect, well, there are cancers that blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, that's useless information. All you're doing is spouting kind of, you know, inflammatory statements.
I think that their position is an extrapolation from what happened with prostate cancer, where this task force was actually very successful in getting their way and modifying behavior. And let me just share with the listeners what that is all about. Prostate cancer screening was something that was introduced in the 1990s on a fairly widespread basis, and it was successful. And the prostate cancer screening led to the early diagnosis of many, many men with prostate cancer. And it was based on a blood test, the prostate-specific antigen, the PSA screening test. And the task force took a number of studies, just like with breast cancer. And let me just say that they use a specific statistical gimmick called meta-analysis. And the reason why they do that is because when a study is done, there's almost never enough patients in the study to have what's called statistical power. So by putting a lot of studies together, they've created a new method of analyzing data called meta-analysis. And the problem with that is that studies are flawed. And when you take 10 flawed studies and put them together to get a bigger study with more patients, that actually magnifies the flaws of the study, and it makes it even less reliable. And that's what recommendations on prostate cancer and some other diseases that I'm involved with that have resulted in recommendations going away from the practice norms. And breast cancer is one of those as well, and that's how the task force has made the recommendations. But I wanted to just share with everyone about prostate cancer, because I think that this is where breast cancer is going. In prostate cancer, and I am a partner in one of the largest urology practices in the Southeast. We have over 40 urologists in our practice. So we see thousands of men every year who are being evaluated for and diagnosed with prostate cancer. Since the task force gave prostate cancer screening a D recommendation, and now insurance companies aren't paying for it and Medicare isn't paying for it, the number of biopsies that have occurred in our practice has gone down 30% in the last 2 years. In the past, one out of every 8 biopsies resulted in the diagnosis of a cancer. Today, it's one out of every 2, which means that, yes, the yield is higher, but there are a lot of men who are now not being diagnosed with the cancer. When I was in residency many, many years ago, 20% of men presented with metastatic prostate cancer. That when they first saw a doctor, their cancer was already metastatic to their bones. After prostate cancer screening was implemented, that number dropped to 5%. Now we're seeing a rise again. And lastly, when we look at the cancers histologically, when the pathologist is looking at them, there's a certain grade that's assigned to the prostate cancer. Well, in the biopsies that we're now doing that are positive for prostate cancer, the grade has gone up one full degree. So that means the severity of the cancer has increased. Now, the prostate cancer is a slower-growing cancer, and the recommendations that are made are based on the fact that many men do have prostate cancer and never have a problem with it. But breast cancer is a very, very different disease, isn't it, Jill?
Yeah, and you know, but your statistics are so true, because as a radiology resident many, many years ago, probably about the same time as you now, you know, we spent our days reading bone scans on men with metastatic disease, prostate cancer. My grandfather died with that. And, you know, now you just don't see it. We're not doing those tests because men are dying, and now that's all going to change. It's like we're walking backwards in time. The technology is wonderful, and it gets better, but the attitude of whoever's paying for it gets worse. And with the evidence-based medicine, I think this is the biggest...
it's a problem.
...biggest point to be made, yeah, with evidence-based medicine. It always sounds good that, oh, well, we have all this literature, but think about who pays for that literature. Most of that is government grants, or grants from academic institutions that are funded through the government in many ways. So if the government doesn't want research to be done that shows that screening mammography helps and is useful, but they want, instead, they want research produced and literature produced that says that screening mammography is bad, that's what they're gonna make sure that that's the research that they fund. And, you know, it's every study is going to have some kind of a bias, whether you really want it to be there or not. As a researcher or whatever, you kind of know ahead of time what conclusion you want it to reach. And somehow or other, most of the time, you're going to have a little bit of bias in every study. And it scares me to think that now the federal government is funding research that's going to prove in quotations, that breast cancer, that screening is bad for people.
Well, it's revisionist history, and what we see is that, you know, you've mentioned about evidence-based medicine, and if a treatment is not supported by what is considered to be a study that is, quote, evidence-based, end quote, then the experts, so-called experts, discount it. They throw it out and they say that it's really not valid. And it really discounts a lifetime, generations of what we call experiential medicine, seeing patients, diagnosing their disease, treating it, and determining that you're actually taking care of individual patients and curing them.
Right.
And this
exactly.
is what, this is population health management. And the problem is that somebody else other than patients are paying for these, and they're just tired of paying for it.
Well, I always have a saying in my talks, when government controls health care, it controls the people.
And
so
it's very
when you let government take over your health care, you got to understand, you just put your life in the hands of the government.
How expensive, you know, the thing that is happening around the country right now is a move toward direct primary care, which we've talked about on this show many times, and other means for patients to directly pay for their health care, to establish a consumer relationship with the doctor that's rendering the treatment. How expensive do these treatments or these screens really have to be? It's my impression that the costs are so much higher because many of them are delivered in hospitals where they can really jack up the prices. But it doesn't have to be expensive, does it?
Well, mammography is hampered by insane government regulation. So we have accreditations, and they just increase the number of accreditations, which is really just kind of a shakedown anyway. You know, so you pay all this money to some entity that has decided that they're going to start some credentialing program. So you have to pay all this money to them and come up with all this paperwork and do all these little meaningless studies and stuff every year and so forth to jump through their hoops for accreditation. So all that goes into the cost of every mammogram.
What if mammography
is unique in that it's harder for us to decrease our overhead and still abide by all this credentialing recommendations that we have to have, MQSA, ACR, NAPBC, all these different entities that start throwing stuff at us saying, you now have to do this in order to be accredited.
What if you didn't want to be accredited, Jill? What if you wanted to open up a, you know, Dr. Vecchio Breast Cancer Screening Center in Colorado Springs? Can you do that?
I could do that. But without ACR, in order to get reimbursed from a lot of insurance companies and in order to get reimbursed from government programs, you have to show ACR certification. MQSA has to, you have to be inspected by MQSA and pass. So you have to do two big certifications. Some of the other certifications are kind of icing on the cake for marketing purposes and all that, even though nobody really knows what that is, or I don't think a single patient knows or cares what NAPBC certification means.
And what if...
It makes us, we do this all year long, we comply. We spend our whole lives complying for a certification in a program that nobody knows or cares about. So if I wanted to just take cash from patients, or if I wanted to be have an imaging center that contracted only with direct pay primary care groups and certain surgery groups, if I wanted to form my own little organization of cash pay physicians and stuff, boy, we could knock down prices like crazy.
And we'll talk.
You're decreasing overhead, and the way that those things are reimbursed is brilliant.
And I want to hear about that when we come back from our break. You're in the Doctor's Lounge.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
You're back in the Doctor's Lounge with Dr. Hal Schurz and my guest, Dr. Jill Vecchio. So, Jill, let's just pretend that you're going off insurance plans and you're going to open up Dr. Vecchio breast cancer screening, and you can set the prices. How inexpensive can you screen women?
Oh, gosh. You know, that would be an excellent question. I honestly can't answer it.
Well,
I can tell you that the initial outlay for the equipment is very high.
Okay.
If you wanted to do the 3D mammography, which I think really is useful, I think there's going to be a CT mammography that will probably be coming out, and they'll have to get FDA, so it may not be available for 10 years or something, but... I think that they can do better with technology, but there's nothing immediate anyway. But those tomography, one machine is $600,000.
Okay.
So you're going to have, you'd have initial outlays that would be very big. It's very expensive to have a breast imaging center, let alone just an imaging center for MRI and all that. But you'd even need an MRI to really be full.
So that
would be expensive. But you could probably, I don't know. I can't really give you a number because nobody really knows what their costs are in mammography.
I just suspect,
Jill,
I suspect that if people were paying for this and doctors wanted to establish a business where they can provide this service and allow a direct financial relationship between the patient and the doctor, I don't think we've talked...
I'm thinking the guys that are doing the direct... pay stuff, primary care, I think, because most of them have arrangements for screening mammography, and it's probably somewhere between $35 and $50 for a screening mammogram.
That's where
that
I'm
is,
going. That's exactly
the
my
primary
point.
Care provider sends, or the imager sends a bill to the primary care provider, and he pays for all of his patients directly. There's no coding, there's no bills sent out, just one bill, one check.
Right.
And it seems to me that that's probably what the reimbursement is, between $35 and $50.
And that's my point.
And those are with imaging centers that are complying with all of these certifications.
So it really is not expensive to do this. And if people were in charge of their own health care and made their own decisions, it really, giving health care, providing health care is not expensive. It's where it's given and the markup involved that's driving up costs. So to say that we're not going to screen women for prostate cancer for breast cancer because it's too expensive is a specious argument when you're looking at individuals and not populations.
Right, because why is it so expensive? Because the government has made it expensive.
Exactly.
I had an epiphany about a year ago. It's kind of like, well, wait a second. Ronald Reagan used to say, he described government in three sentences. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. If it stops moving, subsidize it, which is perfect. And so I thought about that. It's kind of like, well, you know what? Healthcare should not be. Healthcare at this point, with the government paying for so much of it and insurance companies paying for so much of it, healthcare is being treated as a limited resource. So if one person uses it, another one can't.
Right. It's a zero-sum game.
Exactly. So it's being treated as a limited resource. Healthcare shouldn't be a limited resource.
Exactly.
If you let this out in the free market and posted prices and competed, and you know, you gotta keep an eye on the bad guys, obviously, but all this regulation isn't helping, isn't keeping malpractice away.
No.
So it's kind of... the government has taken what should be and what used to be an unlimited resource and turned it into a limited resource. And now it's going to really limit it as a resource so that it's going to really start clamping down on developing technology.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, in another 10 or 20 years, we're going to still be using the same equipment we're using now. We will not have moved forward technologically just like so many other places.
Right.
The reason that we have the technology we have is because of the American healthcare system up to this point that has encouraged free market innovation and technology.
So I want to bring this back to breast cancer screening and the recommendations by the task force. So back in 2009, when the original recommendations were published, there was a huge outcry by organizations and people that you would not expect to get on this bandwagon, organizations like the Susan G. Komen Foundation, people like Debbie Wasserman Schultz, people who are big government people and organizations who all of a sudden saw that this was affecting them now, and because there was a personal connection with this, they didn't like it.
Well, exactly, and that's human nature, isn't it? We don't care about anything until it affects us personally.
And then
all of our previous philosophies go out the window.
So I guess what I'm getting at is that the task force is at it again. They're trying. They have not yet made these recommendations binding. This is their proposal, and. The last time this happened, there was enough of an outcry to prevent its implementation. And in light of our discussion about breast cancer being different than prostate cancer, which, you know, has we've lost this battle urologically, what do individuals need to do to try to keep this from happening and having this go the same way as prostate cancer screening?
Well, you can still make comments to the task force up until May 18th, 15th or 18th. So you can go to their website and actually, if you just Google screening mammography recommendations 2015, it'll come up as USPSTF screening mammography guidelines, blah, blah, blah. And on their website, on the page for the proposed recommendations for 2015, they will have a little bar, a little place that you can click to make a comment. To be honest, I'm being cynical, but I doubt that that's going to have any effect whatsoever. I think what might be most effective is go to your state, you can go to your state legislator and say, okay, when these guidelines come in, does our state health care do our state health care mandates have to comply with those task force guidelines, number one? If they do, then what legislation can we pass as a state to say we reject these guidelines and we're going to abide by American Cancer Society, so that you personally are less affected by it. I think, you know, when you start approaching it on the smallest level, you're more likely to have success. And that's what they did in Colorado. From the 2009 guidelines, the state legislature passed legislation that rejected the task force guidelines, took them out of the state insurance mandates, and put in American Cancer Society guidelines. So that was very effective for us. And I think that's maybe where you'll have the most success as an individual, as a potential cancer patient.
Because they backed down in 2009, and they did that in response to the outcry. So something they did something right in 2009 to...
A little bit, but they refused to take those guidelines off of their website. So the problem with that was, even though the small print said, and those of us who kept in touch with what was going on knew that they had backed off of those guidelines for reimbursement purposes for the Affordable Care Act, some states were still using those guidelines. And when a primary care physician, the information they get is the 2009 guidelines. So I can tell you that our primary care docs have been using the 2009 guidelines.
Yes, it definitely affects
it. And we've found patients that come in and say, what, I have a new cancer? Why did my doctor tell me I didn't need a mammogram anymore?
Because he was going by the guidelines.
Because they were going by the guidelines and they didn't know about the fine print.
Well, I think that we're at the end of our show, Jill, and the take-home message is that federal government is clamping down on individuals because they're paying the bills and the insurance companies will follow suit. And so people who want to preserve their health care freedom are going to need to fight for it.
Absolutely.
Well, Jill, it was really a pleasure to have you on the show. It's been a long time since we've had a long discussion like this, and I hope that we can get you back on the show sometime in the future.
Oh, I'd love it. Take care, Hal. I love this show. This is a great format. I really, really, really like it.
Jill, thank you so much. And I want to thank Dr. Vecchio for being our guest today. I'd like to put in a plug for our show in 2 weeks when my guest will be Dr. Paul Tierstein, who is the president of the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons, and we're going to talk about the maintenance of certification issue, which has created a civil war among doctors in the United States. So until next time, thank you, and you've been listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.